The following is Andrea Resmini's talk, Groundhogs in the Source Code, Navigation as Cross-Channel Sense-Making, from the 2012 Information Architecture Summit. The 2012 IA Summit podcasts are brought to you by User Interface Engineering and the UIE Virtual Seminar Program. Stay tuned after the podcast for a special offer from UIE.
Thank you for coming to the probably the mostly odd, you know, the name doesn't really make sense at first, I think. I'm not sure it makes sense at the end as well, but it has a reason, and I hope I will be able to kind of make a point for you which is meaningful for both the people who are more interested in the high-level discourse about cross-channel experiences and those who actually do the real work in the trenches every day. So one thing I wanted to add to my deck after a few of the conversations that were going around this morning was a point about the fact that when we talk about cross-channel experiences, most of the things I heard were concerned with a very company-driven or company-contained point of view. Cross-channel doesn't work like that. We normally talk about open ecologies when we talk about cross-channel. What does it mean, really, and why is it important for this presentation? Well, if I show you a pair of shoes and you have this company-driven idea that cross-channel is really about the different touch points that your customers or users are going to use, you're probably going to look into who are your competitors and think about shoes and, you know, having better shoes and better websites and better stores than your competitors. But the point is, your ecology is not just shoes. The worst competitor for this item is this one. And that's because the people who actually buy shoes often make decisions about should I buy shoes or should I buy video games. And that makes for a very oddly defined problem space that we need to be very, very aware of. Otherwise, we risk doing things which really don't work for the final users. So this say, this is about navigation. And when we say navigation, what we really mean is understanding. And this is kind of the common thread that we run through all the presentation, even when it seems I'm rambling, actually. So we start like 50 years ago with a book which has been very, very influential in urban planning and architecture, which was called The Image of the City, written by Kevin Lynch. And in that book, this is a view of New Orleans, which doesn't belong to the book at all, but we're in New Orleans. So Kevin Lynch made a number of studies on a number of American cities and found out that actually this is not the way people experience the city, nor it is, you know, the usual top-down map. He found out that people were actually perceiving cities as a number of very, very stable set of primitives that he called in different ways. One of them was edges, so boundaries, things that block your view or guide your path. And another one was paths, things that people use to move from one place to the other. It could have been highways or, you know, paths along a river or in the woodlands. Another one was nodes, places where people actually found stuff happening. And he had others. But the global idea was that the idea of the city that these people interviewed had was very different from the one that urban planners had at the time. It was kind of a systemic view built of different elements combined together, which were very, very abstract in a way. The most famous example you can think of if you think about a city this way is the fact that you probably just go automatically from your home to the place you visit the most. You just go by landmarks or by paths and edges and nodes, and everything is a blur most of the time. You just pay attention to very few distinctive elements. In the 90s, people started to bring these concepts to the web. One of the most notable persons studying in this area was Paul Dourish, and they actually found out that we actually experience the web that way. So through nodes and places we go to, like, you know, a line driving us from Google to the next page or from our homepage to some other service. And this way of experiencing the web is not tied to your level of expertise. It's a common way of perceiving information spaces. And by the way, if you think that this page is kind of weird with a guy who's been dead tweeting, you haven't seen everything, And I don't mean to be disrespectful, but I mean, that's the most amazing thing. So Twitter thinks that Darth Vader is like Jesus, more or less. That's pretty interesting anyway. So, I mean, the web is a strange place, but we perceive it in this way, like this series of things which are connected but are really not, which is the important point that we have to keep in mind. The people experiencing the city that Lynch studied in the 60s were actually making these different physical parts of the physical environment a new recombination. They were putting things together in order to get new meanings, which were personal. My city is different from yours. And that was highly dependent on what these people did and how they perceived their environment, if they were familiar with it or if they were not. And this was a personally meaningful web or mesh that they were building every single time. What we say is that people were, you know, reconnecting fragments in one pattern that was actually meaningful to them. So let's go back a little while and try to get this hunch about why we talk about navigation and why navigation is important in cross-channel experiences. This is the Odyssey, you know the story, I think. It's been written quite a few years ago. It comes from oral tradition, so it's a collection of different things. It's this war in Asia trying to bring Troy down, and the Greeks, who are actually, you know, sieging the city, actually have a very bright idea. Let's build it wasn't a rabbit, actually, but anyway. Let's build this huge thing. And I mean, it sounds like, you know, a weird idea. Let's build a huge, huge wooden horse. They will just take it into the walls. Because that's what you do when you're actually warring somebody. But anyway, the Greeks win the war, but there's this unfortunate king, Ulysses, who actually travels like 20 years to get back home and has a lot of adventures along the way, one of them with the Cyclops, although that's Sinbad over there and not Ulysses, but I mean, it's complicated. I mean, we don't have pictures of Ulysses doing these things, you know how media was not what it is today. And 20 years going places and having the most incredible adventures. The sirens, wizards, witches, Cyclops, everything. Then we have another thing. This is much more recent, even though the youngest over here probably will, you know, don't remember that. But this was a game that LucasArts coded and sold in the early 90s, and it was called The Secret of Monkey Island. You can still see the pixels over there. So this was, again, a story about a young individual who wanted to become a pirate and has a lot of adventures along the way, and it was a graphical adventure. With this guy, you can see the protagonist over there with a shady character with a parrot and doing stuff in a shady pirate town somewhere. And, this is another thing, sorry. I'm not sure. I see something happening over here. But anyway, the guy over there has adventures with ghost pirates and, you know, voodoo dolls and ghost places and gets to see Monkey Island at the end. Again, a lot of places and a lot of stories happening. But this is very, very recent. This is a movie, Sucker Punch. Anyone seen it? Oh, a few of you, good. It's a very interesting movie if you get past the whole male fantasy bimbo ninja thing that is happening through the movie. Well, it's interesting even if you are into that, of course, but I mean, it's a little bit different anyway. So the movie is about this girl who gets basically, how could you say, secured into a hospital because she has troubles, and it's not about Lindsay Lohan, just to be double sure. We could do, you know, some jokes about that, but probably not the right place. So she gets secured into this mental health institute because the family has, you know, a few issues, let's put it that way. So, I mean, the start of the movie is actually quite dramatic in a way. And once she's inside the hospital, a few strange things happen that you have to probably watch the movie like 4 or 5 times just to understand what the hell is happening. But they start to have this sort of, you know, let's call it fantasy without giving too much away of the plot, where they are actually bimbo ninja warriors with a katana and things and bombs and robots and Nazis and things. And they battle these huge things all over the place. So again, this is a story where they visit a number of places and they have to recover a few artifacts in order to be able to kind of make sense of what is happening and escape in the end. So the interesting part again, this is the Odyssey, and this is basically what happened to Ulysses if you try to picture it on a map, the travels he had and the troubles he had. And this is Monkey Island. So again, another map and a lot of places that our guy Threepwood actually visited at the time. And the interesting part is that all these experiences, even Sucker Punch at a different level, and we'll get back to that, are actually what we could call narrative of quests. So a strange blend or a strange mixture or some sort of common ground between different things. They connect maps with the experience, the personal experience of the hero at the center of the stories. If you remember quests, I mean, the Holy Grail is one of the, you know, well, the most famous stories about a quest for the Holy Grail. I don't think those individuals were involved, but anyway. A middle ground between what is simply narrative, the idea of a story, and we know how much important storytelling is, and actionability, for example, in games, the idea that you can do something with the environment that you are actually at the center of your own story. So quests are a strange tool that we can use to shape those things. All three of them actually have some sort of an idea of that. But I want to take you back on another journey. Let's start another thread. So this is probably seems like the rambling part. Dracula, end of the 19th century. Pretty much everyone knows the story. We had like 100 years of vampires everywhere, and we've been basically, you know, totally ruined by what we can see about vampires. And I'm sorry about the quality of the image, but apparently even Bollywood is ashamed of some of the things they do. And you cannot find anything about Kuni Dracula, which is their own Bollywood version of the thing. The white that you can spot over there, it's probably his dentures just coming off during the shot. I don't really understand what is happening with the image. So it's a story we heard a lot of times, and we are kind of spoiled. But actually, the novel itself, which is what I'm going to talk about, is a very complex narrative and very, very interesting with a lot of very peculiar points. Since this is pretty complicated, if I ask you who's the protagonist of Dracula, the novel, do you have an answer? Yeah. Mina, who else? Well, which is kind of strange. Why is the novel not called Mina then? And I mean, the novel was called that way all the time. It was called The Undead before being called Dracula. Well, the point is, no one is the protagonist of the story for real. Dracula is, but he never talks. He never speaks for real. You never hear his voice. You only hear what other people are telling you about him. And those could be lies. And the person who talks the most inside the novel is actually Dr. Seward, who's kind of a lousy character. Dracula is built like an epistolary novel. And at the time Stoker wrote Dracula, epistolary novels were out of fashion like 200 years. So it was not because it was fancy. And it's a polylogic epistolary novel. It means there's a lot of people talking and not just, you know, one person just writing down their diaries. And they use a vast array of tools to do that. In the book, we have dictation cylinders. We have shorthand used to convey information. We have ship's logs. We have diary entries, we have newspapers clippings, we have typewriting, and we have many more of these things, commercial letters, telegrams. It's like, you know, you could say that Dracula is kind of a novel about compulsive blogging at the end of the British Empire, involving a number of, you know, xenophobic Londoners. I think that could be a good definition of the novel. But really, there's a point there. How do we make sense of the story? There's so many people talking, and they go all over the place. They tell us things that are not happening yet, and then we know about facts that have been happening like days before, a week later. Well, Stoker knew that and built a very, very interesting machine. The novel actually is built exactly like the quests that we were talking about, but you don't notice that. There's a phase one, which is entirely happening in Transylvania, in Castle Dracula. Then you get a phase two that moves to London, or actually to England first, a little bit to London, then to Whitby in Yorkshire, where a lot of things happen. Then we get to Carfax Abbey, where, you know, you get the asylum and you get Dracula plotting in the cellars of the abbey. And then there's the whole thing about going back and trying to escape and getting back to Transylvania. So you get really four phases, which are not continuous. Time kind of goes all over the place, but place is consistent. You know exactly where you are. What about Monkey Island? Do you remember the map? That's a lie. This is the game. I would say, this is the game. It's like cinema, it's like movies, it's like anything that you tell when you tell a story. There's no continuity. It's a fake. There's no map. This one is the real map. A lot of places which have nothing in between. And I'm sorry to break it up to you if you don't know, but I mean, movies are not real. So there's nothing happening between when the hobbit and the dwarves leave that place and when they get to lunch in their, you know, motor vans or whatever. The space that we actually experience in movies is actually exactly like the one that we experience in the games and in Dracula and everything else. There's nothing in between the different points. And that's a very interesting thing, because a very famous geographer by the name of Yi Fu Tuan has been working on space and place for a lot of years, and he actually has a very, very interesting way to put it. Place is a way we understand the world. And this is exactly what we are trying to do when we try to work with navigation, and what we are trying to do when we try to make sense of those stories, which are quests. So just to make it even more rambling before driving it home to you, let's try to make the point of why are these things important to us. So this is Groundhog Day. I bet some of you know the movie. And, well, you get this cranky weatherman just going to this place in Pennsylvania where they have this ground dog that basically just predicts how the weather is going to be for the rest of the winter or if spring is coming. So he goes there, has a lot of things happening, and then at a certain point something happens and he gets stuck. He's stuck in time, basically. So things keep happening. He wakes up every morning at 6 o'clock and everything happens again. And for those of you who are into trivia, apparently that happens for like 1,000 years to him or something like that. So it's supposed to happen a lot of time until he gets it right, and then something happens and things move again. But it really gets a little bit crazy during the movie. You can see that the groundhog is actually pissed. So I mean, must have been a cranky weatherman. So this is part of the reviews that came out at the time. Trapped in some kind of time warp. Supernatural forces showing him his weaknesses. It's pretty nice. I mean, that makes up for the movie. Yeah. So, last year, Source Code. Did you see the movie? Some of you? Okay. It's a movie about the idea that we have this big weapon that allows us to go back in time. And so some agency inside the U.S. government, of course, are trying to kind of make it so that they stop a bombing to happen, and they try to save people who have been annihilated on a train. And they send back Jake Gyllenhaal, of course, he looks the part, and yeah, he's Prince of Persia, come on. And he doesn't really understand what happens, but he goes through a number of, you know, things, bad things happen to him, like this train, and for a number of times, of course, and sometimes he wakes up into this capsule where he is and talks to the people who are actually sending him back and trying to make sense of the whole thing, and it happens over and over again. Well, this is the reaction that we had. It's a freaking video game. He's reloading all the time. Oh, that's so neat. And actually, this is the reaction that most of the critics had also, that there's a lot of reviews out which make out the point that this is actually kind of a glorified video game. And they didn't say that because they liked it. I did like the movie, I think, apart from the final 5 seconds. But the point is, what has been changing? Why didn't it say that for Groundhog Day, which is a freaking video game? Everything happens all the time. It still reloads every morning until it gets it right, just like in Monkey Island. You miss the cue, you didn't do the right thing, you die, you wake up, you go back, and you do the same thing again until you get it right. But it was not there. It was magic in the 90s. Okay? So the point is, this guy, Lev Manovich, has a few ideas about what is happening with us as people. And he says that basically we have two different ways of dealing with this kind of things. One is the database, and the other one is 3D navigation. By that, it doesn't mean that we just use databases. It just means that we actually have a way of dealing with our experiences that boils down to these two different ways of doing things. One is the way that we access things in a database manner or in a database mindset, like a museum. What is a museum? It's a database. What about a library? It's a database. And we do these things with a lot of other things that we are not really aware of, like, you know, our drawers or whatever. But what about, you know, the rest, like, you know, going around and shooting guys, like here? Well, that's navigation. Yeah, it's a stretch, but I mean, we experience this kind of information-rich environments, like, you know, museums and things. It's two different paradigms that we use and apply. One of them allows for more narrative, in a way, the database. The other one allows for more actionability, 3D navigation, he calls it. What we are seeing with the movies, what we are seeing with the way we tell the stories, what Groundhog Day and Source Code tell us, and Sucker Punch as well, with this very complex narrative that spans three different environments, which are really just one single story that you don't understand at the beginning at all, except for the katanas, is that these things are coming together. We are learning to navigate the database. And this is something that Manovich really didn't see coming in a way. And I think this is something that we are seeing coming. We had an idea that when, you know, cyberspace was going to be the coolest thing around, this is the idea. Zero gravity kung fu in the construct. Okay? That was awesome, I mean, but really, that's not the way we're going to experience it. This is much more like it. This is the way it's working for us. And we're able to read that, which is kind of amazing. What is happening now is that the language that we use to shape all our media experiences, just like video games, but also like the Odyssey and the story that we tell, we are starting to become more and more familiar with a different syntax from that of physical space and turning that into semantic connections, which is really what Kevin Lynch was talking about. The idea that, well, yeah, you have the city, there's a street over there, which is probably like, you know, a mile long, but you don't get that, you don't perceive that. You just see that there's a corner over there in the tall building, and that's where you turn. And after a few turns, there's the coffee shop you're going to, or your office, or whatever. We don't really perceive physical space just using geometry or using, you know, something that tells us where we turn. We are reading these kind of things in a different way. And given the fact that place is where we stop, where we give names to things, things which are familiar to us, and space is where we move, where we don't want to be. It's the blur in between the edge and the node and the thing I want to do. It's the blur between me and the page I want to get to or whatever my mobile application is giving to me or, you know, real-time displays in the street are leading me to. There's a lesson there for every one of us who deals with cross-channel experiences. Because if place is where we want to be, the rest is not really meaningful. It's part of the travel, but not necessarily interesting, just like what happens to the hobbits in between shots. We care for the storytelling, for the weaving, which might be kind of a lie in a way, even though lie is not probably the right word, but it's still perceived as what is happening. So when you get into cross-channel, the whole mechanism, the whole ecology which is being drawn around you, which is not just your competitors, as I said, or your clients' competitors, we have to use navigation as the tool which allows us to do this beautiful choreography where we move users around. And I mean it, you know, just not by saying that we need to lead them on a leash, because we need to kind of allow them to move around, but not stop where they shouldn't be stopping, or going astray in places where they shouldn't be going astray. Dan Willis drew this map when he was working on intent paths, which is a part of the way that we used to, you know, the tools that we used to describe these kind of things. And this is, again, a map. And I think it drives the point home perfectly if you look at the way that this user, Eva, is going around and around and just moving. And there's a sort of, you know, idea that something has to be avoided or found, just like Ulysses did when he was just traveling across the sea and the isles of the Mediterranean, trying to find a way home. And the basic idea is that navigation, especially in cross-channel ecologies, this, you know, bundle of touch points and paths and experiences and things that we give our users to make sense of what we do, navigation is the way we build sense. That's the only tool that really we have at disposal to build the whole story and to drive them along probably the best path or one of the best paths that they can take and make that a cohesive unity for them, just like the stories and the movies and the video games. And my final point is actually that the language that we use to do this is the language of information architecture. The reason for this is that that's the only layer that we can really affect from start to end, because it's not restricted by the interfaces or the touch points or the specific grammar of any single of the mediums that we're going to touch upon or the channels that we're going to use, because that's where the real issues in respect to the user experience then come in. Information architecture is able to give us those pervasive layers of meaning that go and touch upon all the different touch points that make up the user experience. And navigation is the tool that allows us to actually make them meaningful, I would say. That's it. I try to keep it short. I've tried to keep it short for two reasons. The first one is that I didn't want to bore you to death today, because supposedly, I think Sunday morning, there's a flex track about more of this stuff. There's a couple of people who are crazy enough to ask me about a presentation. It's called The Art and Craft of Being Elsewhere, and deals with, again, movies and video games and stupid stuff that I do normally. But especially if you have any questions, I'm here. So please feel free to kind of, you know, ask anything, except for my bank account. Yeah.
I was just wondering if you could show some examples of some websites or other interactive platforms that successfully use narrative in their navigation.
Yeah, I could have used a few examples, but really the point I was trying to drive home was actually that we need to kind of step up a little bit our game and look into other media who have been developing this sort of narrative and grammar and language for more years than we do. One of the big issues I'm facing as a researcher is actually a way to try to address the idea of what exactly is the grammar that we should be looking upon. How do we do those things? So I thought it was more interesting to present successful examples that have been long-standing in a way. There's a few websites that actually kind of are pretty good at narrating a story, but they're very transient in a way. So I mean, just to make a very stupid, silly example, everybody was in love with Path until we discovered they were stealing our data. So I mean, I would kind of step away from that a little bit and look back and try to bring some of the good stuff that others have been doing into our own field.
Yeah, that makes sense. In practice, navigation is actually kind of disappearing more the more content there is.
Yep.
It's becoming more search-based, so I'm just like trying to marry what you're talking about with how ubiquitous data and information is becoming and how navigation is sometimes becoming less important.
The very short answer is that when I'm talking about navigation, I'm not really talking about the navigation inside one of the channels. So I'm not really worried at this stage or during this talk about how you lay out the menus of a mobile application, but how you structure the whole navigation for the experience, for the customer journey, for whatever you want to call it, that your users are going to do across a number of different devices. So more like the global story than the local story, in a way.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thanks.
Hi, Andrea, I'm Joe.
Hi, Joe.
I really liked it, it was great.
Thank you.
And it's offline, we've been talking a little bit about some of this on the Twitters. And one of the things that I've been working even more on and thinking a lot more on is, you know, what happens when that digital home or that digital path is no longer there, the thing you love is gone type of thing, which is sort of the negative motivation thing of yours is much more positive in the ways. I've been thinking about a definition of place as being time plus space. Time in the sense of duration as well as journey through. And if you could, you know, talk about that, whether that works, and any thoughts you have about what happens when your place, a user's place, digital place changes radically. Thanks.
I would say that time is a big component of that. So this is not just me. It's been research which has been going on for like more than 60 years now. Time is a component because the definition that we normally use for place is that it's actually physical space plus all your personal subjective narratives, your emotional engagement with the place. Very stupid example, just to make it clear. This hotel is very different for us as, you know, participants in this conference, that staff has a different view over the hotel because they do different things, use it differently, have been here more or less, depending on where they actually got the job or anything. So yeah, definitely time is there. Place is eminently subjective and it's very connotated. It's something that you give a name to so you know what it is. You can say it's there. The idea that we're losing places has been going on for like many, many years, and it started out when we got into postmodernity. The whole idea about airports being known places and the mall and the big highways, but what we're finding out is that we're extraordinarily resilient. Place is a thing that we need. And what I'm finding out during my research is that we are making spaces into places by digital augmentation. This is what we do. This is what we do when we use Twitter, when we use Facebook or Skype or anything else. We are actually adding layers to things which are not places for us, but they are becoming so. So it's complex, but I think your definition is pretty there. Time is definitely a component because there's a duration. There's definitely, it's a lengthy process. Yifutuan says that spaces become places through a long, long, long list of absolutely ordinary interactions. So nothing particularly happens, but you just get familiar with things.
I'm curious, do we build the map or do the users participate in that creation?
Oh, they definitely do.
Yeah, I was thinking, so is that just simple, they definitely do? Because I'm thinking, I like the Matrix example a lot, and so Henry Jenkins, who's a media scholar, talks a lot about transmedia storytelling.
Absolutely.
And they have to participate in creating it, but at the same time, we have to have a bigger vision. Everybody talks about that. Fred Wilson talked a lot about participatism, like the users are the one creating it today and postmodernism's dead. So how do you both think of the bigger vision as the architect of it and make sure that they're participating when it rolls along?
two different layers. One of them, of course, users are part of the design. They are co-creators or co-designers or participants, whatever is the level that you decide to draw your lines. From an information point of view, all the big ecologies I've been working on, some including, you know, traffic and, I mean, big things, they're not sustainable if there's no bottom-up input from the users. You can't just push down data forever. It doesn't work. You just don't get the lively, you know, growth of everyday information that gets in. A lot of people have been doing that. The BBC has been championing these things like 10 years ago. So there's a lot of stuff going on. From the design perspective, I was trained as an architect. So the idea that you have to establish policies, that's what you do. When somebody built this building, they decided the doors were there. Some choices you make are good, some others are bad. We know something about, you know, something that doesn't work. But definitely you have to set policies. That's what your role as a designer is. So you build rules and you allow a little bit of bending of them or, you know, changing. And pace resiliency comes into the picture. The idea that you have different layers going at different speeds, and there's a lot going on there. So it's complex, but users definitely are co-creators. You still have to retain, not control, but the global perspective over what is happening, because otherwise there's nothing. Yep.
Hello, Andrea. I'm Lydia. I was just wondering if you can elaborate a little bit on what you meant by we have two modes of sort of perceiving the world, like the database mode and the 3D navigation mode. Can you just explain that a little more?
It's going to be quite complex if I go into details about that, because Manovich has written a book about that, so it's going to be long. But very, very shortly, he believes that those are the two extremes, so it's kind of an exemplification, if you want, of the way we move around and do things. And he believes that those are best embodied by the computer, but they are not just there because of computers. They were actually ways that we dealt with information and with media for all human history. So he believes one of them is more story-oriented, and the other one is more action-oriented. I'm really dumping it down to a level that, you know, I'm, you know, probably just juggling things. But I mean, yeah, that's probably the best thing that you could say. He sees these two different ways, and he sees them as pretty diverging. And one of them is very abstract, the one about stories. The other one is really like building your world or seeing your world while you go through it, the way that you do in first-person shooters. That's the example he makes in the book. I do believe that these things are coming together. Information coming into physical space is bringing all this abstract way of seeing information like they did in the Matrix much more together. So we are actually traveling through 3D space, but in a different way. It's not, you know, you remember Microsoft Bob, the interface where you had, you know, the lounge and the sitting room and things. That's really a thing of the past. We're not going that way. We are starting to believe that, or to understand connections which are just, you know, abstract connections, because that's what we've been doing all the time. Movies are abstract connections of things that we were not able to read at the beginning. And now we do, and we get complex stories. And the same happened basically in every single media. I'm not saying that. McLuhan said that every media starts out by replicating what other medias have been doing before. So we can take it afterwards, I think. I can just go a little bit more in detail over there if you want. Hello. Thank you. Can you use the microphone? Because otherwise, I don't think that. It's dead. Just shout. Google is a place. It's just Google is a place. I mean, it's just another point in the story. And that's exactly how these kind of things worked out. The storyline that we have of the Odyssey is just a coincidence, just an accident in the history of that story, which was probably much, much more longer and had much more episodes than we get now. But it makes perfect sense to us because we've been used to that. When I talk about navigation, I don't think in terms of, you know, building a structure of menus of steps. I think about building meaning into a path. And Google is just another step in the path. I need to go to Google. Google needs to provide me with meaningful things. So it's still not very different from my perspective. It's still just another small thing that I have to consider in order to be able to use it and be bound somewhere else. It's a part of the story. Google and anything else, I mean, yeah. Navigation is between the different touch points. Whatever is in between, I don't care. So Google is one of my touch points, fine. It will bring me to another place, but I will need to get to a place sooner or later. Otherwise, I'm just bouncing back and forth from Google or any other search engine. Yeah. Yep. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this podcast from the 2012 IA Summit. The IA Summit podcasts are sponsored by the UIE Virtual Seminar Program, with scores of online seminars your team can access on demand. For free access to a virtual seminar, visit uie.com/IAS12. And you can find the rest of the IA Summit podcasts at library.iasummit.org.